Welcome back to The Deep Dive. This is where we take, well, a monumental figure, stack up all the source material we can find, really boil it down, and deliver the most fascinating bits straight to you.
Yeah.
Today, we're looking at someone who's just a force of nature. His career, honestly, it feels like a contradiction in terms.
It really does.
We are deep diving into Seth MacFarlane, a creative powerhouse who somehow bridges the gap between, let's say, the absolute crassest adult animation out there.
Right. Incredibly successful animation.
And then pivots to recording these sophisticated Grammy-nominated big band albums, like straight out of the classic Hollywood era, all while being, you know, a really serious advocate for science, for space exploration. It's quite the mix.
It truly is a career that, well, it demands this kind of deeper look.
Yeah.
When you dig into the biographical sources, like the ones you shared, they don't just paint a picture of success. They show an artist who's defined by his ability to operate and succeed in fields that seem completely opposite.
Exactly.
So our mission today really is to trace that path. How did this young animator, kind of obsessed with that mid-century vibe,
right?
How did he become this multi-billion dollar franchise guy, host the Oscars, get acclaim as a singer, and become a patron of science?
Yeah, that's the journey. I mean, a quick snapshot alone, it feels like you're reading the resumes of five different people crammed into one.
Totally.
You've got actor, animator, writer, producer, director, comedian, and singer. And the scale is just huge. Family Guy, American Dad, the Ted movies, the Orville.
Yeah.
It seems almost impossible to juggle all that at once.
And what's really fascinating, digging into the background, is that the seeds for all this diversity, they were planted way back decades ago.
Oh,
this isn't someone who just, you know, picked up a new hobby late in life. It's built on this really intense, almost academic interest in very specific art forms from early on.
Okay, so let's start there at the foundation.
Yeah.
Because the sources definitely paint a clear picture of a very early, very focused creative spark. MacFarlane got interested in illustration at, what, age two? Which is incredible.
Yeah, 2 years old. And it wasn't just like random drawing. He was already trying to nail the likenesses of characters like Fred Flintstone, Woody Woodpecker, icons.
That's serious focus for a toddler.
Absolutely. And clearly more than just a passing phase. By the time he was five, he'd already decided he wanted to do animation for a living.
Wow.
And there's this great family story, and the sources, his parents apparently scoured two whole towns in Connecticut just trying to find him a book on how to make flip books.
Just so he could practice.
Yeah, so he could grasp the basic mechanics of motion, that kind of parental support for such a specific, intense childhood goal. You have to think that was pretty significant.
You really do. And that focus started paying off, like, financially, surprisingly early. By 9 years old, he had a real paid gig.
Right. A weekly comic strip.
For the local paper, the Kent Good Times Dispatch. It was called Walter Cruton. And he was earning $5 a week.
$5, which for a 9-year-old back in the 80s, that was probably pretty decent money.
Oh, yeah, serious pocket money.
And even then, even in that early work, you could see he was already kind of honing that mix of satire and provocation.
Controversy.
Yeah, he talked about doing this strip about a communion ceremony. The character's kneeling at the altar and asks, "Can I have fries with that?"
Oh, boy.
The paper actually published it, and he immediately got this angry letter from the local priest, sparked what he called, you know, a little mini controversy in their small town.
That's a perfect little preview, isn't it?
Right.
Religious satire mixed with lowbrow fast food humor. That's basically the formula for a billion-dollar future.
Pretty much sums it up. So he graduates from Kent School, where he'd been messing around with an 8mm camera, and goes straight to RISD Rhode Island School of Design, majoring in animation.
A top school. And initially, the plan was the classic route, right? Aiming for Disney.
That was the goal. But then came the big shift. The sources point to one specific influence that completely changed his trajectory.
The Simpsons.
Exactly. Seeing The Simpsons showed him that primetime animation didn't have to be, you know, the sanitized Saturday morning stuff or the big epic Disney feature film model.
Right. It could be edgier, aimed at adults, character driven.
Precisely. And that became his new target. This whole period kind of culminates in his senior thesis film at RISD, The Life of Larry.
And this is ground zero, The Life of Larry, middle-aged guy Larry, his smart dog Steve. That is the direct, like the absolute blueprint for Family Guy.
100%. His professor thought it was so good, they sent it off to Hanna-Barbera. And here's a really key detail, something noted in the sources that kind of set him apart early on.
Okay.
When Hanna-Barbera recruited him out to Hollywood, they hired him based on the writing in the life of Larry, not mainly his drawing skills.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, the sources say he was actually one of the few people they hired back then specifically for writing talent.
So he lands at Hanna-Barbera, basically the engine room of modern TV animation back then, working on huge shows, stuff that became Cartoon Network staples, Johnny Bravo, Cow and Chicken, Dexter's Lab.
Right. He described it as this kind of old-fashioned Hollywood structure, you know, constantly shifting writing on one show, then storyboarding on another, fast-paced.
And the sources mention his time on Johnny Bravo was particularly important for his writing development. Why was that?
Well, it seems Johnny Bravo, unlike some of the other shows he worked on there, used a more formal scriptwriting process.
As opposed to just storyboarding?
Exactly. Some shows relied really heavily on the storyboard artist to drive the gags, but Johnny Bravo used actual scripts. For someone like McFarlane, whose whole style would eventually depend on rapid-fire dialogue, punchlines, cutaways, mastering formal scripting was absolutely crucial.
Okay, that makes sense. Because the Family Guy style, it's so dialogue-heavy. Formal scripts force you to focus on plot, on sharp lines. Whereas storyboard-driven shows might lean more towards visual gags, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Dexter's Lab has a lot of that.
Precisely. He needed to nail the art of the written joke, the joke that lands quick. And Johnny Bravo gave him that the rigorous training.
And during that Hanna-Barbera time, he also developed the sequel to his thesis film, right? Larry and Steve.
Yeah, for Cartoon Network's world premiere Toons Showcase, I think it was called What a Cartoon back then. And that short with those, you know, proto-Peter and proto-Brian characters, it really sets up the dynamic we know so well now.
It really lays the groundwork.
Perfect through line. And we should probably also mention his freelance gigs during that time, too, for Disney Television Animation on Jungle Cubs.
Right.
And for Nelvana on Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. He actually credits that kind of work where he was just focused on observing the writing, the story structure, plot points as really valuable preparation.
So he wasn't just drawing, he was actively dissecting how stories were built.
Exactly. Mastering the craft of narrative while simultaneously developing his own much edgier comedic voice. It was all happening at once.
Okay, so the craft is honed, the unique voice is there. And McFarlane's got this ambition for, as you said, edgier primetime animation. So while he's still at Hanna-Barbera, he pitches Family Guy to Fox. Which brings us to, well, the legendary story. The birth and battle of Family Guy.
Yeah, and that origin story is so important because it really explains the show's initial kind of scrappy feel. Fox gave him this, honestly, an almost unbelievably tiny budget for the pilot, just
$50,000. $50,000, that's,
yeah.
I mean, even adjusted for inflation today, what's that, like under $100,000? It's basically nothing for a network pilot.
Exactly, it shows Fox was taking a really minimal risk on this young guy.
The expectations must have been rock bottom. McFarlane described making that pilot as, what, 6 months with no sleep and no life, just drawing like crazy in my kitchen.
Yeah. He had to come back with something very, very simply, crudely animated, basically relying entirely on the script's strength to sell it.
But it worked. Fox liked the tone. They ordered the series.
And boom, July 1998, McFarlane becomes TV's youngest executive producer. He's just 24. And that cemented his multiple roles. Writing, EP, and voicing Peter, Stewie, Brian, Quagmire. Plus others like Tom Tucker, Jake Tucker. But that initial success, it was actually kind of misleading, wasn't it?
Right. This is where we need to really unpack it. Because the resurrection story is maybe his single biggest business win. The show got canceled. Not once, but twice.
Twice. First after season two, I think. Then they brought it back for a bit, then canceled it again.
So on network TV, it was technically a failure.
Initially, yeah. But then something amazing happened in the afterlife, basically.
Yeah.
Home video and cable syndication.
Adult Swim reruns.
Exactly. Cartoon Network's Adult Swim started airing the reruns and the ratings were huge, just enormous. Then the DVD box sets came out.
And people bought them like crazy.
Unprecedented sales. The sources say by 2004, the series had sold something like 1 million DVDs. It was actually making more money for Fox from DVD sales than the original run ever did.
Which just forced their hand.
Completely. So it wasn't just, you know, fan petitions online that there was that too. It was hard, undeniable data from a totally new revenue stream, DVDs, that made the network bring back a show they'd already killed off twice.
That's almost unheard of in television history. Right?
It really is the ultimate, like, counter narrative to conventional network wisdom. And that revival, that power shift, allowed him to negotiate that massive $100 million deal with Fox in 2008.
Wow.
Yeah, securing Family Guy and American Dad for years, and making him, at that time, one of the highest paid TV writers in the world, he basically made the network pay him a fortune for a show they tried to get rid of.
Of course, when you're creating satire on that level, pushing boundaries like that, you invite friction. The show was constantly targeted by watchdog groups, especially the Parents Television Council, the
Oh, yeah,
PTC.
the PTC. They were filing complaints with the FCC, organizing letter writing campaigns, constantly going after the show's content.
And McFarlane's response to them is, well, it's pure McFarlane, isn't it? Just blunt, no compromise.
Absolutely. He famously called them literally terrible human beings. Added something like, "That's like getting hate mail from Hitler. They spend their entire day hating people."
Wow, okay.
It really sums up his whole stance, right? He sees any attempt to censor comedy, to police it morally, as just fundamentally malicious and, frankly, dumb.
Okay, moving on to the spin-offs. We've got American Dad, which is still running, remarkably, since 2005. It even survived network moves, Fox to TBS, and now back to Fox, right?
That's right.
And the initial spark for American Dad was definitely political. It came out of McFarlane's pretty well-documented frustration with the George W. Bush administration back then.
So it started as more direct political satire. Stan Smith is a kind of Archie Bunker
That
figure.
was the initial idea, yeah, sort of all in the family dynamic.
Right.
But here's where McFarlane showed he learned something crucial: delegation.
He largely stepped back from the day-to-day creative side of American Dad. He left it to the co-creators, Matt Weitzman and Mike Barker, to really shape it, give it its own identity, make it distinct from Family Guy's reliance on cutaways, for example.
But he still voices Stan Smith and Roger the Alien, the main characters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's still central, but he let it breathe and become its own thing, which is smart.
And then there's The Cleveland Show, focusing on Cleveland Brown, ran for, what, 88 episodes?
Yep. And notably, that's the only one of his big animated shows where he didn't voice the main character, which is maybe a small sign, but shows he's willing to let other talents take the lead.
But the animation empire, huge as it is, was really just setting the stage for his next big move, a really serious pivot into live action. In 2017, he launched The Orville.
His first major live-action series, sci-fi dramedy. And he stars in it too as Captain Ed Mercer.
This felt like a huge test of his range, right? Moving from 2D satire to like high concept, ongoing storytelling with spaceships and aliens.
Definitely. And the initial critical reaction, it was pretty rough. A lot of reviews called it derivative or too much like a sketch comedy version of Star Trek.
But the sources say the reviews got much better by season two. What changed? What did they pinpoint?
Well, it seems the show itself shifted gears. It moved away from trying so hard to be a parody of classic sci-fi and leaned much more into serious character drama and thought-provoking science fiction plots.
More like classic Star Trek, actually.
Exactly. The kind of social commentary Trek was known for. The episodes got longer, more serialized. They tackled complex ethical dilemmas. That maturation, that shift in tone, seemed to win over a lot of the critics and showed McFarlane could handle drama and complex world building.
And then came the network move. After Disney bought Fox, the Orville jumped to Hulu for season three, New Horizons. That feels significant, like a move for more creative freedom.
It absolutely suggests that. Streaming platforms often allow for longer episodes, maybe fewer content restrictions. It sort of cemented the show's seriousness, putting it alongside other big streaming dramas.
And then there was that weird COVID side effect. A scrapped episode turned into a novel.
Yeah, The Orville, Sympathy for the Devil. An episode planned for season three got shelved due to production delays, so he adapted it and published it as a novella. Just shows he's always looking for an outlet, right? If he can't film it, he'll write it. Doesn't matter the medium.
Beyond the shows he stars in, his producer credits show just staggering range.
Yeah.
He produced the Cosmos reboot with Neil deGrasse Tyson. That's serious science communication.
A huge non-comedy achievement. Really shows him using his Hollywood clout for something deeply educational, carrying on Carl Sagan's legacy. And yeah, some of his live-action sitcom tries, like The Winner, Dads, they didn't last long.
True.
But he also produced Blunt Talk, that star series with Patrick Stewart. Critically acclaimed, ran for two seasons.
Right, about the British journalist in LA.
And he even used animation for direct social commentary with Border Town. Only 13 episodes, but it took on immigration, cultural change through this Border Patrol agent and a Mexican immigrant family. He really does use every tool in the box to talk about what's happening now.
Okay, let's shift gears again to the big screen. McFarlane's live-action directing debut, Ted, 2012. He co-wrote it, produced it, and voiced the title character, that foul-mouthed teddy bear.
And the success wasn't just big, it was kind of historic, wasn't it?
Yeah, Ted had the highest opening weekend gross ever for an original R-rated comedy at the time.
And internationally, it did even better, becoming the highest-grossing original R-rated comedy worldwide, beating The Hangover. It proved his brand of humor worked globally.
And it spawned a sequel, Ted 2, in 2015, and now there's that Peacock prequel series coming out. The franchise just keeps going.
It really does. His next film, A Million Ways to Die in the West from 2014, the Western comedy he wrote and starred in, that got a much more mixed reaction. Critics weren't as kind.
Yeah, it didn't hit the same way. But there's that amazing little detail about it. Apparently, he got so restless or bored during the filming that he spent his weekends writing a novel based on the script.
Just because.
It's just proof, right? The creative engine is always running. If he's not directing, he's writing. And his interest in reviving classic comedy formats continues. He's developing a Naked Gun reboot.
Yeah, with Liam Neeson potentially playing Frank Drebin Jr. How wild is that?
It's wild, but it fits. His career arc goes from reviving Hanna-Barbera tropes to potentially reviving Zucker, Abrahams, and Zucker-style parody. He loves those classic forms.
Okay, now for maybe the biggest disconnect for people, the thing that makes you go, wait, that guy, the crooner career,
Yeah.
the same man who voices Stewie Griffin, possibly the most evil baby in cartoon history, is also this acclaimed Grammy-nominated singer of standards. It is truly the most unexpected part of his profile, but it's also maybe the most deeply traditional. His musical passion comes from this really serious study of, as he puts it, the lush orchestration and old-fashioned melody writing of the great American songbook.
Sinatra, Dean Martin, Mel Torme.
Those are his guys. He genuinely feels that kind of music, that sense of fun, as he calls it, is missing from a lot of modern pop.
And he took it seriously. This wasn't just some celebrity vanity
Yeah.
project. He got proper, rigorous vocal training.
From Lee and Sally Sweetlin, yeah. Coaches who actually worked with legends like Streisand and Sinatra himself.
Wow.
And they taught him the old style way of singing. The sources mention this fascinating technical detail. His coaches apparently drilled him day in and day out on the technique of showing his teeth while singing.
Showing his teeth, why?
Apparently, they argued it helped brighten the whole performance. That level of detailed technical coaching, it just shows how committed he was to getting the authenticity right, just like his commitment to animation structure, but in a totally different field.
And it worked. He got a record deal with Universal Republic in 2010, started releasing albums of traditional pop, easy listening, jazz, swing.
Nine studio albums so far, starting with Music Is Better Than Words in 2011. That one got him his first Grammy nomination.
And how many nominations total now?
Five. Five Grammy nominations for Best Traditional Pop Vocal Album for albums like No One Ever Tells You, In Full Swing. Getting five nominations in that specific category, that puts him right up there with the top contemporary singers in that genre. He's legit.
And his commitment to preserving this music goes beyond just recording covers.
Yeah.
Tell us about this new album, The Lost Sinatra Arrangements. That sounds amazing.
It's incredible, right? Lush Life. The Lost Sinatra Arrangements coming out in 2025. He's basically doing music archaeology here.
How did you find them?
So these weren't just sitting in some public archive. McFarlane actually discovered these musical charts arrangements written for Frank Sinatra by legends like Nelson Riddle, Billy May, just sitting unperformed in Sinatra's own private music library.
Well, just filed away. Lost the time.
Essentially, yeah. Charts written, paid for, but never recorded. McFarlane saw their value, secured the rights, and then conducted the album himself with the John Wilson Orchestra. It's more than just singing standards. It's actively rescuing and preserving pieces of musical history, filling in the gaps.
And he performs live too, right? At serious venues.
Absolutely. Hollywood Bowl, Carnegie Hall, Royal Albert Hall in London, the BBC Proms. He performs as a serious vocalist, not just, a celebrity guest spot. He's taken seriously by that world.
That serious artist side, it really contrasts with his other big side gig, hosting. He was the roastmaster for Comedy Central a few times.
Yeah, David Hasselhoff, Donald Trump, Charlie Sheen. He's the only person who's done it more than once, actually. Shows he can handle that really brutal, high-energy comedy environment.
But the biggest hosting gig, and probably the most controversial, was the Oscars in 2013.
The 85th Academy Awards. He was actually nominated that year, too, for Best Original Song from Ted, Everybody Needs a Best Friend.
Right, and the hosting itself got, well, mixed reviews is putting it mildly.
Yeah, it ranged from people finding it kind of bland or boring to outright outrage.
The big flashpoint, everyone remembers it. The We Saw Your Boob song.
Oh, yeah. That musical number listing actresses who'd appeared topless in movies. Critics jumped all over it.
What was the main criticism? That it was just cheap shock value.
Pretty much. Owen Gleiberman at Entertainment Weekly called it an echo chamber of outrage, saying he tried too hard with faux scandalous gags about sensitive topics, basically arguing he was just importing the lazy shock humor from Family Guy.
But not everyone hated it.
No, it wasn't universal. Some other critics thought he did impressively better than one would have wagered. They felt he managed to balance the sort of required Oscar politeness with a bit of that Ricky Gervais edge, you know, biting the hand that feeds you.
So it was divisive.
Yeah.
Shows how tough it is to bring that Family Guy sensibility to such a mainstream global event like the Oscars.
Exactly. It's a tricky tightrope to walk.
Okay, let's shift focus completely now. Away from the entertainment side and look at the more serious, often very public side of Seth MacFarlane. His activism, his philosophical views, politically, the sources make it clear. He's a consistent, staunch supporter of the Democratic Party.
Very consistent. Significant donations over the years. The sources mention over $200,000 to various Democratic committees and causes. And his endorsements track the modern party line pretty closely.
What, Obama in 08, Bernie Sanders in the 16 primary, then Hillary Clinton for the general, Joe Biden in 20 and 24, and then Kamala Harris after Biden stepped aside. He's also vocal about legalizing cannabis.
And his advocacy for gay rights is really deeply woven into his work and public persona. Even before the Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality, he was speaking out very forcefully, called unequal marriage rights infuriating and idiotic.
That outspokenness, that commitment to equality and critical thinking, led to him being named Harvard Humanist of the Year in 2011.
Which makes sense. But beyond specific political issues, he's been a really powerful voice for labor within the entertainment industry. He seems willing to risk his own lucrative deals to stand with writers and actors.
Like during the 2007-2008 Writers Guild strike. That was a big one.
Huge. And he very publicly sided with the Guild, fully participated in the strike, even though it created this really weird, tense situation with Fox.
What happened there? His contract required him to work.
Technically, yeah. His contract for Family Guy required him to contribute, but because he was striking, he refused. So Fox went ahead and aired 3 episodes that were already finished, but without his final okay or input.
And he called them out publicly for it.
Oh, yeah. He called it a colossal dick move by the network, publicly.
Wow. That must have caused serious friction with the network that basically housed his billion-dollar franchise. Did that damage the relationship long-term? Or did that huge $100 million deal afterwards just prove they couldn't afford to lose him, regardless of the conflict?
It really seems like the latter. The fact that the massive deal came not long after the strike suggests that, yeah, there was definitely tension, but the financial reality of Family Guy and American Dad, the sheer amount of money they generated from DVDs, syndication just made him too valuable.
He had the leverage,
and he used it to support the writers, knowing his product was basically indispensable to Fox at that point.
And that support wasn't just a one-off. During the big strikes in 2023, the WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes,
he put his money where his mouth was, donated $1 million to the Entertainment Community Fund.
$1 million to help industry workers who were out of work during the strikes. That's a massive statement of solidarity.
It really is. Now, moving completely away from Hollywood, his work in scientific and artistic preservation, this might be his most impactful contribution outside of entertainment. And it really speaks to his core philosophy.
Let's talk about the Carl Sagan archive. That's fascinating.
It really comes back to that self-description, a critical thinker. In 2012, he put up the money needed to create the Seth MacFarlane collection of the Carl Sagan and Ann Dreen archive. It's housed at the Library of Congress.
Preserving Sagan's papers, his research.
Exactly. All the materials from one of the most important science communicators of the 20th century. And his reason for doing it, he said it was rooted in his belief in how crucial space exploration is, regardless of whatever trivial stuff is happening in the news cycle. He famously quipped he did it, in spite of whatever Snooki did last week.
Huh. Okay, that archive opened in 2013, making sure all that scientific history is safe.
Priceless educational material, preserved. Yeah. And his love for classic art forms, it goes beyond music. He's into film preservation, too. In 2024, he teamed up with Martin Scorsese, of all people.
Scorsese MacFarlane, that's a pairing.
Right, to fund and showcase the restoration of old animated shorts. The project's called Back from the Ink, Restored Animated Shorts, working with the UCLA Film and Television Archive.
So the guy who created Ted is working with Martin Scorsese to save cartoon history.
It just shows he sees preserving classic art, whether it's old Sinatra charts or forgotten animation cells, as just as vital as creating new stuff.
To really understand the guy, the sources also give us some personal and philosophical context. He identifies as an atheist.
Yeah, calls himself a critical thinker, and he's expressed fascination, maybe even bewilderment, that so many people still believe in, as he put it, the invisible man living in the sky.
That rationalist viewpoint clearly feeds into his comedy. But the deepest personal context, the one that really stops you in your tracks, is the September 11th near miss.
That's right. He was booked on American Airlines Flight 11, the first plane to hit the World Trade Center.
How did he miss it?
Two things, according to the sources. One, he had a hangover from partying the night before.
Yeah.
And two, his travel agent gave him the wrong departure time. Told him 7.45 a.m. instead of the actual 7:40 a.m.
So we got to the airport, Logan in Boston, about 10 minutes late, and the gate was already closed.
Missed it by minutes. And he's quoted saying that the horrific event didn't affect him as deeply as you might expect, which he felt was necessary for his job as a comedy writer, precisely because he didn't really know that I was in any danger until after it was over.
That idea of compartmentalizing, how important is that specific kind of distance for his brand of humor?
Oh, it's incredibly important. Think about Family Guy. The humor is dark, it's absurd, it tackles incredibly sensitive topics constantly. To do that effectively as a satirist, you almost need a certain emotional distance from tragedy.
Right.
If he'd been immediately profoundly traumatized by realizing how close he came while it was happening, it might have shut down his ability to find humor in those dark corners. The fact that he processed the narrow escape after the tragedy was fully known allowed him, perhaps, to maintain that intellectual and emotional remove needed to keep writing boundary-pushing satire.
That makes a chilling kind of sense. Okay, finally, just for completeness, we should touch on the legal side. Creating content that pushes boundaries like his does, it inevitably leads to lawsuits.
Right.
Oh, yeah. The sources highlight three main copyright infringement suits. The most famous one was probably over the I Need a Jew parody song in Family Guy.
Based on When You Wish Upon a Star.
Right. But the court ruled in his favor on that one. Said it was protected parody, fair use. That was a pretty important ruling for satire in general.
What were the others?
There was one involving Jesus performing a parody of comedian art Metrano's Fine and Dandy Magic Act. That one got settled out of court. And then there was the lawsuit against Ted.
Someone claimed he stole the idea.
Yeah, from their concept called Charlie the Abusive Teddy Bear. But the plaintiffs eventually dropped the suit after conceding that McFarlane had created Ted independently.
So the legal fights happened, which you'd almost expect. But his work has generally held up against those challenges.
It absolutely has. And actually, before we wrap up and try to synthesize all this, there's one last detail from the sources. It's wonderfully random and shows his influence goes way beyond Hollywood or music charts. In 2022, scientists described a brand new species of frog they discovered in Ecuador, a Hylocertus frog, and they named it after him.
Get it out. What's it called?
Hylocertus Seth MacFarlane.
Seth MacFarlane the frog.
Even the natural world is acknowledging the guy's incredibly broad, unpredictable reach. Hashtag tag outro.
So when you really zoom out and look at the whole picture of Seth MacFarlane, the thing that keeps coming back is this incredible split, this dichotomy.
Yeah.
You have the traditionalist, the meticulous artist, the singer studying Sinatra's coaches, the preservationist saving Sagan's papers and old cartoons, the guy who writes a novel just because he's bored on set.
Right, that side.
And then, right alongside him, is the boundary-smashing, often abrasive satirist who built this multi-billion dollar empire on, let's be honest, crude jokes, hilarious cutaways, and that initial $50,000 pilot gamble.
And he seems to thrive in the tension between those two poles. He uses the money engine from his arguably lowest brow comedy to fund these incredibly highbrow preservation-focused artistic and scientific projects.
It's like he completely rejects the idea that you have to pick a lane, creatively.
Totally. He refuses to fit in just one box.
So considering that whole constellation of work, you know, his dedication to science archives, his role in literally saving pieces of the Great American Songbook, and that 50 grand bet that turned into a billion-dollar cartoon franchise. Here's something provocative for you, the listener, to think about. Is Seth MacFarlane's greatest skill, maybe, actually, his willingness to invest deeply, financially, creatively, personally, in the fields where absolutely no one expects him to succeed?
That's a great question. Whether it's digging up lost music charts or funding an astronomer's archive, it definitely feels like his appetite for, I don't know, risk and preservation is maybe just as strong as his talent for making people laugh. Or cringe. Or both.
Or both. Well, thanks for joining us for the deep dive.
See you next time.